Excuse me. Well, either the speakers. I guess my question is, do you have a sense of what happened in the post-World War II America that created this opposition to the Second Amendment as an individual right? Is it just, you know, some sort of socialistic idea that this is a better way to control crime? I mean, it just, for 200 years, this didn't seem to be a concern, and all of a sudden, now it is, since World War II. Do either of you have an opinion of what happened in the body politic that made this makes this such an issue?
I've got an answer. I bet Joyce has one too. It really didn't start until the 60s. That's when the collective rights view gained currency, and that's when you started to have otherwise respectable law professors and judges saying things like the right of the people to keep and bear arms does not mean that the people have a right to keep and bear arms. And we had political violence in this country. We had the assassinations that we're all familiar with, and we had some kind of view that this was a great panacea. You could have federal restrictions on guns. You could ban handguns. You could do things like that, and somehow crime would go away. And you have the creation of a viewpoint that if you take the Second Amendment literally, then you're some kind of quack. And you have the majority of the legal profession stampeding into this view that it means nothing, something they would never have done on any other Bill of Rights issue. And it was only, you know, some of us worked hard in the 70s and 80s publishing law review articles, and I don't know how far we got until so-called liberal law professors began to endorse our views. Sandy Levison's article, The Embarrassing Second Amendment, was a real turning point in that. And now you can read in the New York Times that it's respectable to believe that the Second Amendment means what it says.
Yeah, I'd just like to say I agree. I think it was the violence in the 1960s riots and the assassinations that made people think this was such a perfectly easy way to control crime. Just take the guns off the streets. And so, you know, it's so linked up with the Second Amendment that they began to devise ways in which to interpret the Second Amendment that would enable them to do that.
Gabriel, how about the gentleman against the wall there? He had his hand up first.
Yes, I'd like to direct this question to Steve, please. I know you mentioned the British taking away the guns from the colonists, but I was wondering about these school shootings, whether you think it's possible a covert force of a hostile foreign country might be behind these school shootings. For example, Cho, it seems unlikely. I heard he had no military or law enforcement training, but he killed 32 people without being stopped. That'd be easier to do in a conspiracy. And you have, like, even Beslan in Russia. There are these church ministries, Children of Beslan. It appeals to emotions. And they have all these school shootings. Do you think it's possible it could be a conspiracy? Has anybody done any correlation between the various school shootings to determine the possibility of this?
Well, I would attribute the school shootings to the gun-free school zone policy, ensuring that no law-abiding people will have arms to protect themselves and their fellows with, bans on guns even by persons who have concealed weapon permits, bans on guns by professors or people in authority even, and just an attitude of non-resistance, which is taught that there's in this society a culture of you do not resist force, you do what they want, you run. It's a mentality. You don't rush an assailant. Maybe there's more to it than that, but that's what has transpired in my mind, that it's a culture of a panacea of thinking you're going to ban guns from a campus. A person who disobeys laws against murder is really going to take serious these no gun school zone signs, and the whole idea of non-resistance.
A school shooting did result in clamping down in Britain, of course, with the Dunblane massacre. A man came in and shot children and their teachers in a first grade class in Scotland. And after that, immediately after that, there was a terrific campaign, very emotional campaign in the media, to ban all handguns, and led by some of the parents. And they were so successful in getting all handguns to be banned that even attempts to have amendments to permit target shooters, handicapped target shooters, to be allowed to have weapons failed because every handgun was to be taken away. And so in 1997, I guess it was, all the handguns that were out there registered were confiscated. And within 5 years, handgun crime doubled. But that was their approach, and they've been shocked that we have, you know, a shooting in a school and we don't take the same approach.
Okay. We'll try one over here, and then we'll go back over on here. So this gentleman here.
Yes, hi. A question for Dr. Malcolm. I read this weekend in the LA Times that there's a growing movement to openly carry handguns in public across the United States. I was wondering, your research of the English right or duty, was the right or duty to sneak around concealing the guns, or was it sort of normal to openly carry them?
That's a good question. I think that they were generally openly carried. There was the worry that a concealed weapon was concealed because you might have some nefarious purpose. So one of the early laws that restricted guns, long guns, restricted them so that it was okay to have a gun that had a barrel a yard long. Anything shorter, you might have hidden in a cloak, and so that, you know, you were using it for highway robbery. So I think that they were just openly carried.
Okay, this gentleman right here, Gabriel.
Thank you for both the speakers. Let's return to the issue of why elected officials and scholars might argue against concealed carry or open carry or even self-defense with firearms. Speak, please, to the issue that perhaps the officials think it's easier to attack gun possession and firearms laws than it is to actually attack criminals and do something about criminals rather than taking away guns, because perhaps guns don't vote and it's more of a social issue.
Well, you know, it's an elitist attitude that goes with social engineering that those who think they know everything basically set the rules for those who they want to be like clay and to mold them. And so if you have people who are don't have means of resistance, they pay all the taxes because they can't resist that, and they do whatever you tell them. And the danger, they see basically common people as a rabble. They don't trust them with arms. And this goes back to the traditions in Europe, for example. James Madison wrote that the monarchies in Europe were afraid to trust the people with arms, and that in America it was quite different, and the people would be able to overcome an oppressive standing army. So I think it's part of the attitude of a quick solution. You just pass a law. You don't have to change. You don't have to solve poverty or what breeds crime and all of that. All you have to do is pass the law, disarm law-abiding people, and then you can say you've done something.
Yeah, I think there really has become this tradition that you have to leave it to the professionals, that ordinary people would have a gun taken from them. They're in more danger if they try to protect themselves. So the professionals will know how to handle it. Of course, they can't be everywhere, but that doesn't matter. And particularly in Britain, they even started this walk on by. If you see crime being committed, you're to walk on by, you know, and maybe call the police. And at one point, a few years ago, the BBC, when they were having another of their crime waves and gun crime waves, issued a series of instructions of what the average person was allowed to do, right? And one of the things, you were not to call help, I thought was quite interesting. You were supposed to yell, "Call the police," because no one was supposed to help you, you see, except the police. And then if you were able to knock down your assailant, you were not to do any more than that, because if you harmed him, then you would get arrested for assault. So they just want, I don't know, this passive public. It seems to me they must realize the police can't be everywhere at all times. And the ironic thing about the D.C. case is, of course, that the mayor is claiming they can't stand by and let people die. But, of course, it was D.C. that had this landmark case that's where the police were proven not to be responsible for protecting any one individual. You know, so they're to protect. There's your collective right. Everybody's protected, but no one individual is protected by the police. So it's a whole attitude, I think.
Another gentleman right here.
On the some constitutional commentators have said, as a textual analysis, that drafter intent or drafter purpose and intent is not useful to understand what the meaning of the text is, and that instead it should be the meaning of the words when they were written to a normal layperson. And I'm just wondering, obviously you've said what the drafters were kind of thinking, but is that also the common understanding? You mentioned the state constitutions, but also how those state constitutions were interpreted. Were the things written, did people know exactly what they were getting into? Did they know what those state constitutional amendments meant to be able to apply them to the federal constitution and say that's what we want and that's what we want more of?
One of my favorite statements about a Bill of Rights was by St. George Tucker in his Blackstone's Commentaries published in 1803. And he said that a Bill of Rights is not just for the government. It's also for the person of the meanest disposition or education, meaning the ordinary person, to understand and to enforce those rights if they're violated. So it would be a rather strange Bill of Rights if the sole persons to interpret it were the ones who were also the ones who would be violating it. And so he said that basically it's for the ordinary person to learn about, to educate themselves about, and to know when their rights are violated so they can do something about it. And in line with that, what do you do about it? We have free speech, we have suffrage and things like that. And in the ultimate analysis, we have an armed populace that acts as a dissuasive factor from too much oppression and tyranny.
And one opinion of Justice Marshall's, he talks about how to interpret the Constitution and says it should be interpreted, according to the simple meaning of the language. So I think people were very feisty about what they thought their rights were. I think they had a kind of keen understanding.
This gentleman right there.
I've seen a writer on Book TV who argues that there were lots of local laws against firearms, and I can think of one example that we know from the Old West, and that was Wyatt Earp's putting in various cities, towns he was in charge of, putting a ban on carrying your guns in the town limits. And I was wondering, I'm interested in how badly could the D.C. City Council, what sort of law could they pass that would still have us disarmed, even if the Supreme Court should come out with the way we hope they will?
You want to go first?
Oh. All right. I think that what they could do is allow people to have guns in their own homes. I mean, they could still control carriage on the street, but, to just get to that core right of people being able to protect themselves. So if they simply allowed people to be able to have a weapon in their own home and use it for their own defense, that seems to me something that they could do, and then still try to control what happens out on the street as a sort of separate issue.
What I would say is probably what they will do if the Supreme Court rules not only that it's an individual right, but that the handgun ban is invalid. And I'm sure they're doing this now. They're drafting regulations to try to make it very onerous to have guns. It's already very difficult to have any kind of firearm in the District of Columbia. It's got to be registered. They have a weird definition in which they define most semi-automatic firearms as machine guns, which cannot be registered. So even if the handgun ban is invalidated, you could only own a revolver. You could not own a semi-automatic pistol. At least according to that other definition, which didn't get litigated. And so sitting in Mayor Fenty's shoes and knowing the way they think, I believe they probably have already anticipated what could happen, and they're going to make it as hard as they can on you. There's already provisions in the D.C. Code now, things like you've got to be a person that the police chief deems you can have a gun and use firearms competently and safely. You can imagine a person who's handicapped who maybe wants to collect guns but does not shoot them because they have one arm and they want to have a collection of rifles, for example. So you've already got some potential for mischief there, and I don't doubt at all that they're drafting provisions to make it onerous.
Very depressing thought.
Could you identify the militias that's referred to in the amendment? Are these militias state, local, or county, and who belongs to them?
Well, at the time of the founding, the militias were simply the people who would turn out to defend from danger from whatever source, and it might be, in the case of the Revolution, it was the Brits. It was the official government. It might be foreign invasion. It might be some kind of domestic tyranny. There was, of course, the Federal Militia Act that I mentioned, all able-bodied white male citizens. The word white was taken out after the Civil War. All the states at the time of the founding had militia acts, which required enrollment in a militia. And it was basically a situation of you live here, you're going to be required to help defend the society. And it was considered to be because you had all the ordinary people in it, a way to prevent a standing army from arising and oppressing people. But, I mean, these militias in the revolutionary context sprang up spontaneously, and there came a time when many of them were organized under state laws. But when the Second Amendment refers to a well-regulated militia, it doesn't mean one with lots of what we mean by regulations today. It means a disciplined militia, a body of people who can get together and defend themselves and their society, which might mean people who know how to shoot straight safely and how to act together.
They also had age limits. There were certain age definitions. Originally, it was something like 16 to 65, and then they changed it to 18 to 45. And those were people, and it wasn't voluntary, the original militia under the British or even under the American Republic. It was, you were obliged, if you were able-bodied, to be a part of the militia. So it wasn't a voluntary association. During the war and before that, the Minutemen were voluntary, but the government's militia was not voluntary. It was, you had an obligation to be in it.
Yes. Should there be a line drawn where individuals can or cannot possess certain arms, anywhere from single automatic to fully automatic to even high explosives, and even to the militia, is it appropriate for militias to own warheads in this day and age?
Go ahead.
Well, first of all, in the case before the Supreme Court, D.C. and also the United States take the position that, well, you shouldn't invalidate this handgun ban because then people can, or there might be arguments they can legally possess all those things you mentioned. And just to get this straight at the beginning, the only issue before the court is handguns, and the court made that quite plain in the oral argument. Now, the Second Amendment itself, if you look at it textually, refers to the right to keep and bear arms. So I think there's some limits there in terms of what arms would ordinary people keep in their homes and what could they bear. So you cannot bear heavy weapons. You cannot bear artillery. You can certainly bear rifles, pistols, and shotguns. If we want to talk about the outer limits of that, machine guns and other things like that, there's really never been any debate on that in the scholarship. The Supreme Court in the 1939 Miller test case sets a militia-type test for that, leading to the argument that one could possess a machine gun under the Second Amendment. Now, in this country, You may not know this, but under federal law, you can legally own machine guns. You can legally own artillery. They just have to be registered with the ATF. So we don't have a complete ban on that kind of weaponry, although some states might. Now, at the time of the foundings, individuals owned cannons, and certainly militia units had cannons, and there's still in existence the Right and Honorable Militia Company in Boston. They have more words to that than the Right and Honorable, but that's part of it. I forgot the other words. So it's an artillery company, and it was a company under the auspices of the state government, but they owned their own artillery at one time. They probably don't now. So the way that I see this debate at this point is about whether you can have what everybody recognizes to be ordinary arms, the same kind of ordinary arms that law-abiding people have always kept. And yes, it's certainly theoretically interesting to argue about other kinds of implements and weapons, but the real debate in this country is over ordinary firearms.
Did you have a question? Yeah, okay. Gentleman here.
As I read the Second Amendment, it explicitly refers to, as you know, a well-regulated militia necessary to the security of a free state, state meaning like Virginia or Massachusetts, etc. Security against what? Security against foreign invasion, and at that time, security against the danger of terrorism by the federal government itself. There was that concern at that time. So looking at the Second Amendment as worded, it seems to me that today a well-regulated militia is something that the founders never envisioned, namely the National Guard. Yeah. And all the guns used in the National Guard are provided by government itself. So where does that leave the Second Amendment? In my view, applied to the D.C. gun law, the D.C. gun law is not unconstitutional, but very unreasonable. So why haven't the speakers tonight mentioned the National Guard as being, so far as I can see, the only example of a well-regulated militia necessary to the security of a free state? Thank you.
That's a good question. The militia was supposed to be independent, and it's become more and more and is now officially a part of the Army. The whole idea that it would protect people against a tyranny in the government makes no sense if the militia is now under the control of the U.S. Army and the federal government. And the Second Amendment would be just an artifact if the main clause didn't say the right of the people to keep and bear arms. So it's not the right of the militia to keep and bear arms. I think as Steve Halbert mentioned, the comment about the militia being the proper security of a free state is really a declaration in favor of a militia. People were very afraid of a standing army. And so I think that it was a way of saying, well, it's the militia that really we want to be protected by. And there was some concern during the convention and actual amendments that in order to have a standing army, you would have to have 2/3 vote of each House of Congress or even 3/4 vote. They were so worried. But it was mentioned that at that point that if you had something like that, this would be a mark of dishonor upon the army, that you distrusted them. So I think it seemed better to simply make this comment that it's the militia that is the right security, rather than saying we don't trust the army. But they sort of paired it with the other clause, which I think has caused a lot of confusion.
I'll just add that in the language of the preamble clause, a free state, one might argue, would be a state government, but it also in the political vocabulary of that epoch, a free state meant a free society. And in fact, the first draft by James Madison of the Second Amendment, he refers to a free country. So the idea was to preserve and secure a free country, a free political society. And for what purposes? Well, the text of the Constitution refers to the suppression of insurrections, repelling foreign invasions, and enforcing the law. If the law, if there was a breakdown such that the militia had to be called out for that purpose. So there were federal aspects where basically the feds could induct the militia in the federal service, but the National Guard is kind of a hybrid. It's considered the militia of the states when it's in the state service, but when it's in federal service, it's part of the U.S. Armed Forces and not militia. And the Supreme Court made that decision in U.S. Versus Perpich, basically upholding the sending of National Guard units abroad in the Central American conflict of the back in the 80s. So the term militia to the founders meant basically all able-bodied male citizens. I think today it would be considered all able-bodied citizens without regard to gender. But to secure a free state, to have this well-regulated militia, and to try to de-emphasize standing armies, that was a political principle. The founders wouldn't say something like duck hunting being lots of fun, the people have a right to keep and bear arms. They said it with the important federal objective of promoting a militia, and the only way that could be done was to recognize the right of the people to keep and bear arms.
Can I just add one thing? I thought one of the interesting notes in the appeal in Heller was that the D.C. claimed that since they weren't a state, the Second Amendment didn't apply to them.
Thank you. Now that we've gotten into this term of state, and just continuing along that line, it seems to me that there were no states at the time of their writing of the Second Amendment. There are plenty of colonies, but did they think of the state as a geopolitical unit, or perhaps the state as a state of being, or a state of freedom, a free state?
Well, the Declaration of Independence refers to free and independent states, and they were virtually independent of each other. When the Constitution gets adopted, they have stronger federal ties. So when the Second Amendment was proposed and ratified, obviously, they were already states, and it was states that was ratifying the Second Amendment.
Yeah, I think that they were using state in the term of, as a polity rather than just, so that the district would be included.
Any other questions? The gentleman right there.
Back in colonial days, there used to be laws that said you had to go to church with arms or you were not, or you were fined. What happened to those? When did they fade away?
Good question.
Light question.
When they were no longer being attacked by hostile Indians.
Okay, well, I want to thank you all for joining with us. If you give a round
Good
of applause
questions.
For our speakers. And thank you for joining with us and making this such a great event. Dr. Helberg's book is available for those who are interested downstairs. It's at a special discount only for this event. And I'm sure he'd be delighted to autograph copies. I hope that you'll join with us for future events and perhaps even become members of the Institute for future discounts and so forth. We're delighted that you could join with us. Thank you and good night.